Good morning, everyone.
Steve Wojcicki today.
Today is May 8th, 2022.
Really, we're very ignorant about
headquarters.
Science.
My name is Mark Perez, and I'm here to welcome everyone to our headquarters and to those who are in
the
ancient television audience,
science,
or whatever we're calling it, YouTube, I guess.
Science.
I'm still thinking in the 1970s.
They were very competent.
But we're happy
so
that you're here, too.
And
certainly we
want
to say Happy Mother's Day to all
the moms
who are out.
Going back 3 and 4
and I spoke with a biologist to make sure that what I was about to say is absolutely true. And that is it true that none of us would be here without mothers?
I mean, we can.
It's true.
They were
it's our first scientific factoid that we got today. So I want
to
make sure you know that's biologically accurate.
So, and incidentally,
thank you very much again to Hugh Ross, who brought sandwiches, and thank you to others who brought treats as well. Thank you for doing that. Appreciate that. For those of you who are new to this location, if you go through that door, you'll see a sign that says restroom. Just go to the right and make a quick left, and you'll be good to go.
Pump water,
and with that,
Hugh,
it's all yours. Thank you.
They understood the principles of levers and pulleys. As a matter of fact, a paper got published where he said, if you look at Stonehenge and these huge vertical rocks that they have there, it says they had the technology.
Well, welcome to the Paradoxes class. And this is part two of a three-part series. But just want to remind you with my first
hole in the ground. Because you go to Stonehenge, only two-thirds of the rocks are above the surface. The other third is below. And what they would do is they would dig a just right shaped hole. But literally,
Science of Leave has its own YouTube channel, and there's literally thousands of video clips there that you can access and you can subscribe.
So the whole point is,
RTB does have a
available at that time, and when they knew at that time, they could achieve everything we see in ancient civilization. They don't need aliens to tell them.
Does maintain a Facebook and Twitter page where we take questions and we post
at that time. Had all the knowledge.
Simply a reminder,
and
if you don't get to ask your question today,
what I'm arguing in the
Q&A time,
is they were way more motivated.
You can always
today.
Ask questions on my Facebook. The three-part series we're going through right now is addressing the question: Are we alone?
They got that from their
what has the Bible got to say about this? What has the Book of Nature got to say about this? I mean, that's
And instead of putting our
doctrine of the
Christian one true God, we worship the creation.
The Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture.
Religion,
and last week we looked at what the Bible's got to say about this issue, basically making the point that it's quite wide open, which explains why Christians for 2,000 years have been debating this subject. Did God create other life forms in the universe, or did he only create life here on the planet Earth? And so there's only rather limited constraints from a biblical perspective. The Bible,
how those gods treat one another. They treat one another.
Whether or not we're
humans treat
not.
One another. That's about, one of the unique things about the Bible's message compared to the religions that surrounded the ancient nation of Israel. The gods of the Egyptians, the gods of
relatively
the Akkadians, they're gods that are just
biology.
As immoral as we are. So they're killing one another,
beyond
they're raping
planet
one
Earth.
Another, they're behaving just like we're behaving. So once again, as Romans 1,
we can develop
we're transferring the worship from this morally pure, perfect God.
Whereas the Bible allows a lot of
to what we see that's created.
Discussion
so the very fact
we're going to see is that
the
universe
are representing
has put significantly stronger constraints on this question of exohabitability.
They're no different than people today.
Book coming out.
I run into highly educated atheist scientists who say, isn't it amazing what nature has done?
At least. And that book goes into a lot of detail. So a lot of what you're hearing today, next week, will be from this book, designed to the core. But you'll also find a lot in this book, The Creator and the Cosmos.
Get a microphone to you.
Came
no,
out
actually,
3 years
not,
ago.
Because,
and you can get a free chapter
kind
of that book.
Okay.
Yeah, so
you can bring your questions next week.
Yeah,
but as I said at the beginning, we're going to have about 30 minutes for teaching and about 40 minutes for Q&A because I want to protect your Sundays.
The book so, designed to the core.
You can save your questions for next week.
I want to begin.
A couple of weeks ago, didn't get chance to get posed, and it comes from Tom Wee in Germany.
Studies of this particular
Dr. Ross, thanks for your detailed answers to my questions.
E46,
he says, are there any in the RTB community who, like me, would take a day-age interpretation of Genesis 1:1-5,
a modulated electromagnetic signal coming from this galaxy
10 billion years from the initial creation event 13.7 billion years ago
until the translucence has now been decoded by a supercomputer, which says it's being broadcasted.
Good question.
We're calling about your car's expired warranty. This is a courtesy call. This is the last call we will make before we close your file. Please contact us to resolve this. It's an extraterrestrial life is multilingual. Apparently, they're communicating this not just in English, but a lot of other languages. Maybe English and Mandarin. And ET, however, apparently is not intelligent enough to figure out how to close my file because I keep getting these calls repeatedly. Well, let's get on to the serious part of this talk. And that is, what about the origin of life? Is the origin of life even conceivable from a naturalistic perspective? And what we've learned...
Creation Day 1. And in my book, Navigating Genesis, I cite Jack Collins. He's actually going to be here for our Dual Revelation workshop. I also cite a member of our San Jose chapter.
But as we go in...
A physicist who is fluent in the biblical Hebrew,
context.
Roger Whitefield. Both of them have analyzed the first three verses of Genesis, making the point that the grammatical structure, and particularly where the verbs show up in the sentence,
first from Carl Sagan, it was a short course, but in that course he talked about the origin of life, and what he basically said,
the Spirit of God begins moving over the surface of the waters. And likewise, there's a period of time between what you see in Genesis 1:2 and Genesis 1:3, where you get to the beginning.
At least a billion years. But we learned about the origin of life on planet Earth.
Thank you. And with that, would you dismiss us in a prayer?
Sure. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for this technology where we can meet in person, get a good quality recording, and at the same time engage people through YouTube Live. And Father, I pray that you would help us to continue to improve this experience for all.
So we got a rather well-established
and Father,
date.
Especially I pray that you open each of us up that to receive more grace from you. Thank you for the time we had today to talk about your grace. Lord, grant us the humility that we can receive more of your light, more of your love, and more of your truth, and more of your life. And Lord, give us the love.
We have the universe
that, with other people we meet this week. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, thank you.
Hi. 5 minus 0.006. And was the atheist was there has to be some feature in the physics and chemistry life, the very first moment condition. It happens in an immediate instant. And both Carl Sagan's comment that there's this vast prebiotic carbon 12, then postbiotic molecules. The sugars, these are the building blocks of proteins, RNA, and DNA. And in these. In these carbonation. We see no evidence of prebiotics. Planet Earth has no evidence of prebiotics ever existing to the Earth. If here we should see the isotope signature, we don't. Paradox, and he made reference to Uri back in the 50s, where they took a big flask and they put molecules in there and the spark in and tried to. Without oxygen, you're not going to have ozone in the stratosphere. And if you don't have ozone in the stratosphere, there's nothing to stop short wavelength ultraviolet radiation from the sun. That ultraviolet radiation stops the prebiotic chemistry. Right. Got oxygen, the chemistry will not operate. If you don't have oxygen, the chemistry will not operate. By the way, regularly, every single one of them has several Origin of Life researchers talking about what's called the homo. Is that
you can have. It's really weird because. So this four. Yeah, four is. You can't see this, can you? Yeah, 529225. That's number three. See that?
Be left handed, or they all have to be right handed.
Or you have the wrong microphone there.
A random mixture of molecules. And so the challenge has been in Origin of Life research, how do we take a mixture of randomly left and right handed amino acids and work it so left handed? The only way to make any progress towards chirality is to find some physical or chemical environment whereby you're destroying making that happen. Lab experiments under highly controlled conditions where you got these biochemists with the best possible equipment working, they're not 80%. Left-handed and 20% right-handed. And the experiments they've done demonstrate that long before you get to 100%, you have no sample left. Because after all, you're destroying both the right and the left-handed. You're simply destroying the right-handed. All the experiments tell them you're not going to get to 100%. Long before you get to that, you've got no sample left. And DNA molecule. dry bones. And again, and the 50-50 left and right-handed. And again, there's no naturalistic pathway to get them to 100%. And here we have another problem. There just isn't a lot of ribose in the universe. Ribose has recently been discovered in meteorites. It's yet to be discovered in an interstellar molecular cloud. And that's disturbing for naturalistic origin of life researchers, because that is the source. Meteorites get their ribose. Clouds, any ribose. We've yet to find any sugars, more complex than a 3-carbon sugar in these interstellar molecular clouds. We'll eventually find ribose in interstellar molecular clouds. We've already searched for it at 1 billion. Our best per million, per billion, but however, enough research has been done to tell us that we've is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're out of sync, wireless.
All right. Okay. Hopefully this will increase the sound quality here. Okay. Yeah, I was making the point that we've yet to find any of the building blocks of origin of life molecules in these interstellar molecular clouds. None of the ribose sugars, none of the nucleobases, and none of the amino acids. But there was papers published about a decade ago where they said, we think we've discovered glycine in interstellar molecular cloud. That's the simplest of the amino acids. It's only got 10 atoms in it, but a couple of years ago, a subsequent paper was published in the same journal where they said, we misidentified the spectral lines. We have not found glycine. Likewise, they claim to have found a nucleobase, but that also got withdrawn. So as of today, we've yet to find a single amino acid or nucleobase or any of the 5 or 6 carbon sugars that life needs in any of these interstellar molecular clouds. But again, I'm predicting we soon will, but we're going to be finding them at abundance levels below a part per billion. And at that abundance, that's of no help to any naturalistic origin of life model. And that got demonstrated the last Origin of Life research conference we attended, where they devoted Wednesday evening to answering the question, do we understand where the building blocks of Earth's life molecules come from? And 5 leading origin of life researchers got up and spoke. They all agreed, where they said the answer is no. We do not understand where these building block molecules come from. Furthermore, they all agreed, we don't even understand where the building blocks of the building blocks of life molecules come from. Which explains why. And also, we got the problem that we go back 3.825 billion years ago and look at the isotope evidence of Earth's first life. it's not a single microbe. The isotope ratios tell us that there had to be an entire ecology of microbes, and not just microbes with only 500 gene products, microbes with at least 1,500 gene products, basically making the point Earth's first life was very complex. It's not as simple as what Carl Sagan claimed decades ago, and it's not a single life form, it's multiple life forms. But this explains why astrobiology got launched. They basically said, we can't understand how the origin of life got started on Earth. It couldn't have happened on Earth. It must have happened elsewhere. It got transported to Earth. And the favorite location is Mars. And, you know, there's been, I think now, 22 meteorites that have a Martian origin that have been recovered predominantly in Antarctica. And they've analyzed all those. And you may remember there was quite a bit of excitement back in Bill Clinton's era, where they thought that one of these Martian meteorites had signs of life in it. That claim has been withdrawn several times. But the problem when you go to Mars, or for that matter, any other extraterrestrial site, you don't bypass the problems we have here on Earth. You've got the same problem that if the origin of life happened elsewhere, it happened without time. Because if you're going to claim that life was transported from somewhere beyond Earth to Earth, the problem you run into, it takes a minimum age of the universe to get the chemistry going. And that minimum age is about 3.8, 3.9 billion years ago. So that's the earliest that this kind of chemistry can operate within the universe, so you don't bypass the time problem. And one thing you have on Mars that you don't have on Earth is what's called the carbonate crisis. And we now know that if you go back 4 billion years, small parts of Mars were warm and wet. We see evidence that liquid water did exist at that time. But unlike Earth, Mars did not have long-lasting, strong plate tectonic activity. Its core features didn't allow that to happen. And so once you've got water and the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it reacts and makes carbonates, and there isn't the plate tectonic activity that's able to take the carbonates that were made from the chemical reaction of carbon dioxide and water and convert it back to carbon dioxide and water. So Mars today has lots of carbonates, but there's nothing to recycle the carbonates back to carbon dioxide and water, which explains why over the past 4 billion years of Martian history, it's been cold and dry. And we now know this is going to happen any other planet that lacks the strong, enduring plate tectonic activity of a planet Earth. Yes, it could start off warm with carbon dioxide and liquid water, but it's going to be quickly converted into carbonates, and the planet will be driven to a dry, cold state. And what I explain in a chapter of Design to the Core, the book that will be out in June, is that if you've got a rocky planet more massive than the Earth, it's going to have weaker and less enduring plate tectonic activity. And if you've got a planet that's less massive than planet Earth, likewise, you're going to have a planet with weaker and less enduring plate tectonic activity. And moreover, the planet has to have the same density of planet Earth. Well, I won't go into all the details here. As you can see, you're really running into the same problems that you would have here on planet Earth. But this next slide basically reveals why Earth escaped the carbonate crisis and why Earth has an enduring magnetosphere. The problem with Mars is there's no magnetic field, no magnetosphere enshrouding the planet that protects the planet from deadly solar and cosmic radiation. So any chemistry that we could get going there would immediately be disrupted by all the cosmic and solar radiation. That didn't happen on planet Earth because planet Earth has had a strong magnetic field, a strong magnetosphere that has shielded the planet from this deadly solar and cosmic radiation literally as far back as 4.5 billion years ago, literally to within millions of years after the Earth was first formed. And we now understand why you got this event where the solar system actually begins with 10 planets, not 8. It begins with 5 gas giants and begins with 5 rocky planets. And one of the gas giants got kicked out by an interaction it had with Jupiter and Saturn. And what happened to the 5 rocky planets is that 2 of them were very close to sharing the same orbit. You got the proto-Earth, and you got a planet called Theia. And very early in Earth's history, we have Theia colliding with the Earth. And so these 2 planets, rocky planets, collide with one another, and it's a low-velocity collision at a high attack angle, which means it's more of a merger event, where Theia merges with the proto-Earth, and we wind up with a bigger planet, Earth, and also that collision led to the formation of the moon. We would have no moon if it wasn't for Theia and the Earth colliding and merging in a highly fine-tuned way. And you'll see this at the reasons.org website. And actually, there's going to be a chapter it's actually part of it's an improbable planet, but there'll be more detail in the book Design to the Core, where we make the point that when lunar formation modelers were looking at this, they said in order to get an Earth whereby life would be possible in the Earth for a long period of time, and get the moon so that the moon would also be have the right, just right features so that life can exist on planet Earth for a long time, you need extraordinary fine-tuning. And this so disturbed the lunar formation modelers, they said, we have to redo all the models. There's way too much fine-tuning here in order to explain why life exists here on planet Earth. They redid all the models, and they all got published in the British journal Nature. And I cite that particular issue in an article I've written on this and a chapter in Design to the Core, where they wound up with way more fine-tuning than what they started out with. And it was Tom Elliott, and it might be Tim Elliott, it's T. Elliott. He wrote a little commentary in Nature. He said, all this fine-tuning is causing us philosophical disquiet. Way too much fine-tuning to explain this naturalistically. But what this did is it gave the Earth a very hot core, and it also gave the Moon a very hot core. Hot enough core, and the collision event also resulted in both the Moon and the Earth being enriched in iron and in nickel, and those are ferrous metals, which means they can be easily magnetized. And so both the Earth and the Moon wound up shortly after the collision event with an inner core, a hot liquid inner core of iron and nickel. Now, that wouldn't normally give you a magnetic field. You can have liquid iron in the core of a body, but if it's not being circulated, there's no magnetic field. You get no dynamo. But what happened is 4.4 billion years ago, we got the early Earth and the Moon about that far apart from one another. So that's all to scale. And by the time you get to 4 billion years ago, they're still relatively close together, the Earth and the Moon. And so for about the first 500 million years of the existence of the Earth-Moon system, you got both bodies close enough together that you have, for example, the gravitational pull of the Moon on the near side of the Earth being significantly stronger than the gravitational pull of the Moon on the far side of the Earth. And of course, the same thing happens with the Moon. The gravitational pull of the Earth on the near side of the Moon is much stronger than the gravitational pull on the far side of the Moon because of how close they are together. And it's that difference in gravitational forces that circulates the liquid iron and nickel in the core of both bodies. So previous to 4 billion years ago, both the Moon and the Earth had a strong magnetic field. And that strong magnetic field caused a magnetosphere to form around the moon and a magnetosphere to form around the Earth. You may have heard of Earth's magnetosphere referred to as the Van Allen belts. It's basically a magnetic shield. We will take questions, but the way we're doing the paradoxes class now, I get to speak uninterrupted, and then we're going to have an extended time of Q&A. So I will take your questions afterwards. And hey, my message is only going to go about 30, 35 minutes, which means I'm almost done, and then we're going to have Q&A. So just we'll get there. Okay. But what we're seeing is that you had this magnetic shield around the Earth and the Moon, but because of close together the bodies are, the magnetospheres actually couple. And so this is where the Earth-Moon system is now. So far apart that the magnetic fields of the two bodies are not able to couple together. But previous to 4 billion years ago, the two bodies are close enough together that the magnetosphere of the Moon and the magnetosphere of the Earth couples together to give a really powerful magnetic shield around both bodies. And it's that powerful magnetic shield around both bodies that prevented the early sun from sputtering away all of Earth's water and all of Earth's atmosphere. You know, this particular graph shows you the flaring activity, the particle radiation, the X-ray radiation coming out from the sun. All that's what is being shown by this curve here, basically making the point that if you go back to the first 500 million years of the existence of the Earth-Moon system, we got the sun's particle radiation and X-ray radiation about 10,000 times stronger than it is today. So the scale is logarithmic. Today, we're experiencing the minimum particle radiation and flaring activity and X-ray radiation for the sun. But the young sun was much more potent in all of those features. And if it wasn't for the coupled magnetosphere of the Earth-Moon system, we would have lost all of our water and all of our atmosphere, and there'd be no life possible on planet Earth. This got published about a year ago, and it's in my new book, Design to the Core. But we now, and the authors who published this said, this is a key factor for life to exist on a planet, and applies not only to planet Earth, it would apply throughout the entire universe. In other words, as we mentioned last week, there could be life elsewhere in the universe if God created life. As I mentioned earlier, it's not going to happen naturalistically, but there's nothing stopping God from supernaturally creating life on another planet, just like he did here on planet Earth. What we now know is that it would have to be a planet-moon system identical to the Earth-Moon system, where you got this big rocky planet being orbited by a gigantic single moon. And that's just one of 22 design features of the moon that need to be exquisitely fine-tuned in order to make advanced life possible on planet Earth. So in terms of the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life, my comment based on this recent discovery, don't even bother until you find a planet-moon system that has the identical origin, way it formed through a merger, and where you got the bodies of the same size composition and the same dynamics. Now, today, the moon is far enough away, and by the way, the moon being a smaller body, its liquid iron core is now completely solid. There is no liquid iron core in the moon today. It is cooled, and so there's no magnetic field. The moon has not had a magnetic field in the past 4 billion years. Earth, being a bigger body, still has a liquid iron core, but no longer is the moon close enough to circulate the liquid iron core and make a magnetic field. So this is the way it was when the Earth had a moon orbiting about it close enough that the moon could circulate the liquid iron in the core of the Earth. And today, the Earth still has a liquid iron core, but a good chunk of it, because of its cooling history, it now has both a solid inner core and a liquid outer core. And so the fact that we now have the Earth with a solid inner core and a liquid outer core, that by itself is sufficient to circulate the liquid iron in the outer core. Why? Because trapped in that solid inner core are some light elements, oxygen and sulfur and carbon and hydrogen, and that's being squeezed out of the inner core into the outer core, and that movement of those light elements through the outer core is sufficient to strongly circulate the liquid iron and explains why we have a magnetic field to this day. Now, so what's going to happen in the future? Well, in the future, as the Earth's core continues to cool down, it's going to be just like the moon, where it's all solid, and then we're going to lose our magnetic field. So is that going to happen tomorrow? No, it's not going to happen tomorrow. We've got a good few tens of millions of years left before that happens. But it's already such that we can measure that Earth's magnetic field is projected to get weaker and weaker as we move into the future. Now, in terms of when we can actually measure that, about a million years from now, we'll be able to see that the magnetic field is indeed getting weaker. And so it's this collision event which explains why we still have a liquid iron core, but there's another factor explaining why we have a liquid iron core, and that's the fact that this collision event and the way the solar system formed, which I'll be explaining next week, explains why the interior of the Earth is super endowed with uranium-235, uranium-238, and thorium-232. Those are radioisotopes. They're long-lived radioisotopes. I mean, uranium-238 is about 4.4 billion-year half-life, 235 about 0.7, and thorium-232 about 14.1. And so this is a second contributing factor explaining why the interior of the Earth is as hot as it is and why it hasn't cooled to a point where we've lost the liquid iron core. But here again, we've got another habitability requirement. In order to have advanced life on a planet, as opposed to just microbes, you're going to need a planet that has this hyperabundance of uranium and thorium in its interior. When I say hyperabundance, I'm not kidding. Compared to other rocky planets in the universe, our planet has 630 times as much thorium-232 and 340 times as much uranium. You're sitting on the uranium-thorium champion of the universe, and you wouldn't be here if our planet wasn't so super endowed in uranium-thorium. So next week I'll actually be talking about how we got that enrichment, but I'll end here, but I'll give you a little teaser for next week. We've only talked about one planetary habitable zone. There's actually 12 other known planetary habitable zones. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 13 known habitable zones. And hey, we discovered number 13 just a year ago. Literally every year we seem to be adding another habitability requirement. And so this is at least suggesting that from a cosmological perspective, an astronomical perspective, it's becoming more and more apparent that indeed we're alone. Now, not necessarily alone in the sense that there might not be other planets with microbes on it, but if we're talking beings like ourselves, or even creatures as advanced as dolphins, it appears astrophysically that the evidence is increasing that indeed we are alone. So the Bible doesn't give us a definitive answer, but it seems like the universe is giving us a definitive answer. And I'll get into this more next week. So with that, I'll take questions. And like always, I'll take questions on any subject. It doesn't have to be what we talked about today. So I know there was a gentleman here. He'll be back soon. He had a question.
Hugh, I have one.
You got one. Okay.
And what are the strongest or the most frequent arguments against the position that you're espousing here?
Well, the strongest evidence is they say we know we have life here on planet Earth. we're all convinced there is no God, so it happened here on Earth. If it happened here on Earth, why can't it happen again? So yeah, the atheist is basically making the assumption that the origin of life on planet Earth is naturalistic, and if it's naturalistic, given that there's 2 trillion galaxies in the universe and 1 trillion planets in the universe, surely it happens somewhere else. That explains why I spent a good chunk of this talk on why a naturalistic origin of life model. Well, I wouldn't even call it a model. I mean, what we're seeing when we attend these conferences, they don't even have a scenario, let alone a model for a naturalistic origin of life. I mean, they've got these ideas. Well, maybe RNA can simultaneously make DNA and make the proteins. And so they call it the RNA world hypothesis, where you start off with this primitive RNA molecule, and it evolves to produce DNA, RNA, and proteins. But I remember at the 2002 Origin of Life conference, the Origin of Life researcher was most strongly promoting the RNA world hypothesis. He walked back and forth. He gave the first plenary lecture. He walked back and forth from all of us in the audience and said, I hope there are no creationists in the audience for what I'm going to say next. It would take a miracle for an RNA molecule to show up on the early Earth. And of course, we wrote down his quote verbatim, and it shows up in a couple of our books. And Leslie Orgel has passed away, but since that time, in the past 20 years, his statement has become even more evident given the advances in origin of life research. Now, having said all that, there's a lot of them that are making the point, while it's one thing to rule out advanced life, we cannot rule out primitive life. And I would agree with them. We have yet to develop the cosmological, astronomical observations to definitively say that there's no microbes elsewhere in the universe. So that's open. In fact, I've been on public record since the 1980s. We will find the remains of life on every solar system body, but not because life originated there.
In our solar system.
In our solar system, but I've also been on record in saying we're not going to find it on exoplanetary systems. It's one thing for a meteorite to take a microbe from planet Earth and deposit it on other solar system bodies. It's not going to be able to deposit it on planets orbiting other stars. They're just too far away.
Now, these 12 planetary habitable zones, are each one of them independent? In other words, if you lose one of them, you lose habitability?
Most of these 13 are independent of one another. There's only a couple of them where there's a dependency factor. So yes, if you lose one, you've got no. In fact, each one of the 13 must be in place to have any chance of life on the planet. So take one of them out, you're in trouble. And I purposely spoke today about what I think is the most definitive one, the fact that you have to have an Earth-Moon system with the identical features and the identical formation history of the Earth-Moon system.
Your response to the earlier question on what was the best arguments against your position sounded like the people who are arguing against it were arguing from wishful thinking and not from evidence. Am I understanding that properly?
Yes, and part of the problem, Mark, is that the astronomical astrobiology people don't often talk to the chemists that are doing these experiments in the lab. And so they're thinking, in fact, as I talk to astrobiologists, they're saying, well, look at the great progress they're making in these chemistry lab experiments. But I say, well, have you actually read their papers? And what they're saying is, we're having to manipulate things in order even to get the baby steps for the pathway of the origin of life. My colleague, Faisal Rana, has written the book, Creating Life in the Lab, where he talks about how biochemists with advanced technological equipment, highly controlled lab conditions, are able to take certain microbes and engineer them to do different things. But he says there are a long ways from creating life from scratch. But he says, notice the intellect and the knowledge and the funding and the technology is necessary even to come up with these tiny steps. and kind of the conclusion of his book is someone a lot more knowledgeable, more intelligent, with greater technology must have done it in the first place. As a number of original life chemists have pointed out, hey, we're making all this progress in the lab, but notice we're always working with pure chemicals under highly controlled laboratory conditions, and those conditions never exist outside the laboratory. You always have chemical reactions that are disrupting things at the same time they're constructing things. That's something you see in all the lab experiments. They ensure that none of the destructive chemical reactions are operating, but that never happens in the real world. Yes, you're next. Yeah, the details of the lunar formation model is that you've got Theia and the proto-Earth colliding, merging with one another, and a debris cloud forms around the now bigger Earth, and it's that debris cloud that condenses to make the moon. Yeah, so the moon comes out of the small condensates that are the direct result of that merger event. Oh, all right. Okay, I won't bring sandwiches next week then. You're going to bring pizza. And by the way, it's always a treat when he brings pizza. So.
Well, there you go, Samuel.
So there's a question that I've been having for, gosh, decades. Anyway, so the last, you know, there's a lot of interest in UFOs. And so there's a scripture in Job that I've always wondered about. I'd like to get your take on this. So it's Job 1:6. And now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was with them. What is your take on what that means?
Yeah, good question. Sons of God comes up in a couple of places in the book of Job. You also see them in Genesis chapter 6. And then they're mentioned frequently in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, the term sons of God can refer to humans or it can refer to angels. But we notice in the Old Testament, humans in the present tense are never referred to as sons of God. There's only one passage, it's in the book of Hosea, where it makes the point that some humans will become sons of God. And the New Testament points out that that's when they become redeemed from their sin and evil. Because what you see in the New Testament Gospels, Jesus, the Creator, never refers to his disciples as sons of God. In the epistles, they're only called sons of God. So they're sons of men in the Gospels, they're sons of God in the epistles. And notice too, Jesus never referred to himself as a son of God. He called himself the Son of Man throughout the Gospels. In the epistles, he's never called the Son of Man. He's only called the Son of God, which at least suggests, if doesn't prove, that the requirement for a human being to become a Son of God is that they're redeemed by the blood of Christ shed on the cross, and they receive the offer of his eternal salvation. So with the day of Pentecost, we see the transition of the disciples of Jesus becoming sons of God, which would indicate the sons of God in the book of Job are not humans. It's referring to angels. And likewise, you would see that in Genesis chapter 6. It'd be referring to angels. Although some theologians will claim that the sons of God in Genesis 6 may be referring to demon-possessed humans. But either way, you got the angels involved. And then what you see in Genesis 6, the sons of God there are not righteous angels, they're the evil angels. Whereas in Job, it's used generically referring to all the angels. So it includes the righteous angels as well as the fallen angels. And we have a book of reasons to believe called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. We also have a television documentary we did called The R-UFO Hypothesis, where we talk about how do you explain the UFO phenomena. I won't go into all the details, And I've been studying this since I was 16. I always had the job of handling the UFO reports at every institution where I served. And I'm on record as saying the vast majority of what people report as UFOs are not really unidentified flying objects. They have explanations. Natural phenomena, military activity that's being kept secret, and a lot of them are hoaxes. But there is a residual, and the residual, we're convinced, is a manifestation of fallen angels. Because they violate the laws of physics, and yet we can prove they're real. And in terms of the contacts we've had with humans, it's never beneficial. It's always deleterious. But we got a whole book on it. And it's a testable hypothesis where you say, if you get the occult out of your life, it's the occult that invites demons to come into your life. If you take that away, that'll be the end of your UFO encounters. So we have a testable model. It works the other way, too. Bring the occult in your life, you're going to start having these experiences.
Yes, in the Old Testament, Adam is called the son of God.
Yes.
How would you explain that?
Well, before he sinned, he could legitimately take the title son of God. After he sinned, no. And then you see in the New Testament where it goes to the genealogy. One of those gospel genealogies takes you all the way back to Adam, and he's called the son of God. But it's making the point that there was a time in his life when he was not in a fallen state. And so humans that have been redeemed from their sin can take the title Son of God. Humans that have never sinned can also take the title Son of God. But that can only conceivably apply to two people, Adam and Eve. They're the only two that began their lives without sin in their lives.
What do you think of the Book of Enoch?
I think the Book of Enoch is an apocryphal book. Everybody agrees it's an apocryphal book. And I'm not saying that the apocryphal books are without value, but there's a reason why none of them have made it into the canon of the Bible. Beginning with the 3rd century, Christians gather together and determine, okay, of all these books that claim to be inspired scripture, which ones really are inspired scripture? And they came up with a set of criteria. It's a set of criteria still used to this day as to whether or not a message or a book really is something we need to consider as the Word of God. And a couple of the requirements was the message needs to be at least claimed to be spoken from God himself rather than just from a human source. It cannot violate the moral message that we see in the Torah. So if we see in the Torah, the commandments, the Ten Commandments, if any apocryphal book it violates that, then this is not the Word of God. If any of the prophecies that are made, predictions of future science or future history, do not come true, then this is not the Word of God. And it's something that Moses said, you can tell a true prophet from a false prophet. A true prophet, everything he predicts about the future will come true. A single mistake means, or a single false prediction means, this is not a message from God. There are other characteristics too. In terms of, I wouldn't say that the Book of Enoch is the best of the apocryphal books. In my opinion, the best of the apocryphal books are 1st and 2nd Maccabees, because they faithfully record the history of what happened to the Jews between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. But the reason why they didn't make it into a scripture, because they were both kind of speaking from God, but they do advocate for vigilante murder of the enemies of Israel, which is a violation of what you see in the Torah, the moral code. So, in my opinion, they come the closest to making the cut. The Book of Enoch. And the other thing was, in terms of when they're written, the fact that the earliest manuscript we have for the Book of Enoch is as late as it is, argues that this is not something from Enoch himself. Now, you do see Enoch mentioned in the Old Testament, and we can easily conceive how a human author, thousands of years later, would look at that and embellish the story. So I'm not saying all parts of the book of Enoch are false, but clearly there's embellishment there that's not correct. Yes. Get him. Oh, you got it. Okay. We got an internet question. Okay.
I find the moon and Earth being so close together 4 billion years ago, do we have any idea how close that moon was to the Earth? Because what's 240,000 miles now? What was it then?
Well, it was at what's called the Roche limit. And I forget exactly what the distance from the Earth is for that. But the Roche limit is where the moon would be so close to the Earth that the gravitational force on the near side would be so much stronger than gravitational force on the far side is that it would split apart the moon. And clearly that didn't happen, so the moon had to start off just outside that Roche limit. But all the models tell us it was very close to the Roche limit. Well, I can't pull it off the top of my head. However, that diagram I showed you, that's really close to the Roche limit. So it's about a factor of four Earth diameters away from the Earth is pretty close to the Roche limit. So we're talking about 32,000 miles. Yeah. So it might be 24. It could be. That's right. Well, I'm talking about it's roughly four Earth diameters. Three or four Earth diameters is the Roche limit. And, you know, to give you an accurate number, you actually have to look at the composition of both bodies to figure it out. So, again, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. Right. Well, you know, part of the amazing fine-tuning is Earth started off with a rotation period barely over 2 hours per day. So it's a very fast-spinning body. But the tidal friction that the moon exerted on the Earth was slowing down the Earth's rotation rate. So today is 24 hours. The tidal forces we get from the moon are still working to slow a rotation rate. So if you go back 150 million years ago, the rotation rate was 23 hours a day. You know, 150 million years in the future, it's going to be 25 hours a day. But what I write about in Design to the Core, if you want to have global advanced human civilization, it's got to be 24. You don't want 23. You don't want 25 for a variety of reasons. It's got to be 24. And where you really see the fine tuning, maybe I can go back to this slide here. Right here. You want to hit 24 hours a day when the sun is most stable in its luminosity and has the least amount of flaring activity and X-ray radiation. So where you see that dotted line, that's where you are right now. You want that to coincide with the Earth having a rotation rate of 24 hours a day. So that just invokes a whole lot more fine-tuning into the Earth-Moon system. It's not only got to be fine-tuned to get you that coupled magnetosphere when you really need it for the first half billion years, you also need the Earth-Moon system to be designed in such a way that the Earth's rotation rate goes from 2 hours a day to 24 hours a day in just the right time period that you need to coincide with the sun having minimum flaring activity. And hey, I could reel off another 18, but that just gets you started. Yeah. Okay, he looked it up. So it's about 1.5 Earth diameters.
Could you say that number? 11,000?
11,470 miles.
Thank you. That way they hear it out there. I got two questions from the internet. One's really should be a quick clarifying question on one of your terms. Josie Wales says, the fine-tuning requirements should be distinguished from the distance from the sun. When you say zones, I get the idea of astrological dynamics and distance. When you say carbon monoxide zone, carbon dioxide zone, you're not talking about distance, you're talking about the other fine-tuning. Is that correct?
Partly, because in order to get the carbon dioxide and the carbon monoxide just right, you need a certain distance from the sun. You need the sun to have certain precise features, the earth to have features. So yeah, and that's true of all these what are called planetary habitable zones. Let me just pop ahead here. I'm going to do this next week. But this is kind of a basic definition of a planet habitable zone, where the planet must be relative to its host star in order to be a zone where it's conceivable to have life on the planet, but also requires a star to have certain characteristics and the planet to have certain characteristics. So yeah, what's called the planetary habitable zone is not just the distance between the star and the planet. You'll also have to take into account the features of the star and the features of the planet. So in that sense, the carbon monoxide habitable zone actually is a planetary habitable zone. And this will all be described in quite a bit of detail in the book Design to the Core.
Okay, great. Great answer. Doug McCone asks a really good question. I've often wondered, if angels have no gender, or they are neither male nor female, does this throw out the biblical interpretation that the fallen angels procreated with humans in Genesis 6?
Yeah, the Bible is silent on the gender of the angels. Many people presume that the angels must be masculine, based on what you see in Genesis 6, 2 and 6, 4, where it says that the sons of God came to earth and had sexual intercourse with the daughters of men. And so if you interpret that literally, and not all Bible scholars do, some Bible scholars claim the sons of God are the offspring of Seth, or that they're demon-possessed people. But if you believe that they're actually angelic beings, then that means they must have masculine features. But the Bible doesn't really get specific about the sex of the angels. It does seem that they all have the same sex, but again, the Bible isn't explicit. But based on everything we read in the Bible about angels, it does appear that they all have the same sex. And of course, these are beings that are not constrained by the space-time dimensions of the universe. So there's a possibility that they don't have sex, but they got the capability, the power, to take on sexual characteristics. A lot of speculation here. We deal with a good deal of that in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. What we do see in the occult literature and in demonology is that when humans have close encounters with demons, the fallen angels, it's quite clear that they seem to be, one of the consistent features of people that are demon-possessed, or you come into contact with demons, they seem to be obsessed with sex, and especially obsessed with immoral sexual behavior. You know, my own experiences where I've encountered people that are demon-possessed, one of the things I've often observed is that they will be spewing out all this talk about sexual depravity and claiming that the sexual depravity is something that is good. And where I've really been horrified is where they insist that Jesus was involved in these sexually depraved acts. That's one of the clear signs I see of demon possession. There's a lot of people running around that are wicked, but typically they draw the line. They'll stop short of accusing God of sexual immorality and depravity. But demon-possessed people, I've often seen that happen. So there's something about sex that's obsessive to the fallen angels. We do not see that with the righteous angels. Over here.
Yeah, that's not the Bible that says that we're supposed to reproduce without trying. I mean, that would apply to the animals, but would that not apply to us too? So we cannot then.
Okay, his comment is, isn't the Bible pretty clear that we're to reproduce after our own kind? And therefore, we humans shouldn't be having sex with non-human animals. And likewise, the angels shouldn't be having sex with creatures that are not part of their species. And you actually see a reference to that in Jude 6, where Jude talks about how God locked up certain fallen angels and put them in the abyss. And it's a prison house for a certain category of exceptionally evil fallen angels. And what it says there, the reason they're there is because they left their estate. Now, that's what comes across in the English. In the Greek original, it would be consistent with interpreting that because they committed bestiality, because they had sex with members that were not of their own species, which many people believe is a reference back to Genesis 6, 2, and 4, where it talks about these sons of God coming. And what you see in Genesis 6, they came before the flood, they came after the flood. And then the offspring of this was the Nephilim. So that's a major part of the debate too. Okay, these sons of God had intercourse with the daughters of men and gave birth to the Nephilim. So that's a whole other subject. Who are the Nephilim? You know, when did they exist? And I devoted an appendix to that subject in my book, Navigating Genesis, basically laying out the different interpretations of who are the Nephilim. What we can know, where all sides agree, is that Nephilim were evil individuals, and therefore God sought their extinction, and that's one reason for the flood, was to wipe out all the Nephilim. But it tells us in Genesis 6 they came back. But notice that God raises up Moses and the Jews, and especially David and his mighty men. David and his 30 mighty men eliminated the last of the Nephilim. And I just say that because I hear Bible teachers on TV saying that Nephilim are still running around today. I'm convinced they're not. The last of the Nephilim were taken care of by David's mighty men.
Earlier, I had asked about what was the strongest argument against your position, and it sounded like that was just a wishful thinking of the people who disagreed with you, or disagreed with the position, not necessarily just you. And what I'm wondering is the reason that other scientists aren't coming up with what you're coming up with, that they aren't engaging all of the disciplines that have something to say about it?
That's a good point. If all you're looking at is, say, the genetics or the evolutionary biology, and not looking at the solar astrophysics, you might think that there's a better chance for life spontaneously arising and evolving into intelligent life than you would otherwise. What I am seeing, particularly in the astrophysical literature, though, there's an increasing consensus amongst astrophysicists, and this would include even the atheists among them, that we're not going to find intelligent life elsewhere in the universe that, like us, are constrained by the physics of the universe. But a lot of them are persuaded that they think we're going to have a good chance of finding microbial life. And so it's called the rare earth hypothesis, that the possibility of finding a galaxy cluster, a planet, a moon, a star, sufficiently like our star, galaxy, planet, and moon, is so ridiculously remote. This is the only place in the universe that's going to have advanced physical beings like ourselves. But they said we got a much broader possibility of finding a body with microbes on it. And, you know, and part of it is there's now a recognition in the astrophysical literature that we humans must be the first. So there's people speculating maybe advanced life will come after us, but they know they can't predate us. And the reason why is it takes a minimum of 13.79 billion years for the universe, given its physics, to produce the conditions in which advanced life and advanced civilization is possible. So there are papers being published saying there's a possibility for intelligent life after us, but not before us, which is basically being used as a critique against the project of searching for extraterrestrial intelligent life. making the point that if they're far away, that means they have to predate us. And if they have to predate us, we already know the physics of the universe doesn't allow that to happen. And that's because if you're looking, say, at a star that's 20,000 light years away, it's going to take a minimum of 20,000 years to receive the signal. So any signal we receive must come from the past. And it looks like the past is not an option. But the future, some people will claim, is an option. I'm personally not convinced that the future is an option. Because as I look at the future of the universe, it's like conditions are going to worsen in terms of habitability for advanced life.
Thank you. Okay, I don't seem to be raising your hand, so I'm going to go for it again. There's a principle in the philosophy of science called consilience. Consilience is the principle that if you're doing a set of experiments in a discipline, that you would want experiments from different viewpoints conducted to agree. And when they agreed, say if you're measuring the distance of a star, you might measure it in three different ways. That's consilience. And I'm wondering if we ought to also consider consilience in disciplines, not just merely experimental consilience in one discipline, but consilience across a number of disciplines to verify that the conclusions that they're making are not merely within their own discipline, but that their conclusions that they're making, for example, evolutionary biology, saying that naturalistic original life is possible, it wouldn't just be biology that would be answering that question. It would be biochemistry, it could be astrophysics. So the consilience there would be broader because the question is broader and unanswerable within just one singular discipline.
Right. I'll give you an example of that, Mark. There's a paper that's been published by 33 astrobiologists, but it includes people from across a broad range of spectra in terms of the scientific disciplines. And basically the conclusion of this paper, it's a big, thick paper, they're saying there's no way we're going to get the origin of life on planet Earth. There's no way we can explain the Avalon explosion of animals or the Cambrian explosion of animals. That's off the table. And they bring in all these people from different disciplines, saying if we integrate across the scientific disciplines, if we apply Bayes' theorems to the probabilities, we can definitively rule that out. Which is why they close the paper off by saying panspermia is the answer. Life helping happen elsewhere, and some big asteroid or comet or whatever brought life to planet Earth 3.825 billion years ago, but other comets brought back the genomes of animals 575 million years ago for the Avalon explosion and the Cambrian explosion. And there's been several papers published recently basically making the point panspermia is the only game in town when we start to integrate across the scientific disciplines. But again, you could apply your principle of consilience saying, is that really a viable game? And so I'm in the process of writing an article saying, if we apply the same principles that they employed to rule out a naturalistic origin of life on planet Earth, it simultaneously rules out the idea that some meteorite could come. Well, at the end of the paper, they actually concede that as a possibility. Maybe future research will prove that we can't get the genomes of life from another planetary system sent to us by an asteroid or a meteorite or some big rock. Maybe it really has to be directed panspermia, where we've got an intelligent race that's purposely sending spaceships to planet Earth at regular episodes and depositing life on planet Earth at the different times that are necessary. I remember back in 1999 where one of the Origin of Life researchers came to the Q&A microphone and made explicitly that statement. And I remember Fuzz and I saying, I think they're getting close to the right answer. It really is directed panspermia, but it's not a being that's like us from another planetary system. It's a being beyond our planetary system. And a number of the Origin of Life researchers behind us heard it. They said, we know exactly what you two are talking about.
I think we're up against our end time now.
Well, we'll meet again here next week. And yeah, kind of the format is, we'll introduce, I'll teach for roughly 30, 35 minutes, and then we'll have about 40 minutes of Q&A, and then we're going to let you all go. But next week, I heard we're going to have pizza. So thank you. All right. See you next week.